Hey folks, welcome to the BioCast, episode 7. This is an interview with Joe from Red Light Man. We talked about various aspects of mostly red and near-infrared therapy. The website is Resonant FM for all links, the podcast feed, and social media. Thanks for listening. Hey Joe, thanks for coming on the show. I think I came across your website maybe a year ago, researching red light. Can you tell us how you became interested in the subject?
Hey Shane, thanks for inviting me on. So my name's Joe Gibson, also known as Red Light Man. I was originally educated in pharmacy at university, but I grew unhappy with the whole pharmaceutical industry as I learned more about it, both in terms of effectiveness of drugs, side effects, and just general business ethics. And since then, I've become interested in health and nutrition. And I found out about red and infrared light being used as a therapy, and I kind of became obsessed. I think it was actually through Danny Roddy that I first started to take light therapy seriously.
It's one of those things where it seems to be very effective for a lot of different conditions, and there's not a huge amount of, say, side effects or drawbacks with it, really.
Yeah, sure. I haven't really come across any serious side effects, apart from if you're using it, you know, ridiculous amounts of energy for ridiculous amounts of time, but it's generally quite safe.
And what did you then buy some devices yourself and start experimenting, or what were your experiences with it?
Yeah, so when I first got into red light, I bought a 10-watt LED panel just with all red LEDs.
Right.
And I tried using that just on my head, on my face, on my back, but I didn't really notice anything. I was still interested in it in general, so I decided to buy my own LED chips. Bought some heat sinks, drivers, soldering irons. I learned all about electrical circuits, AC and DC. And I built my own products, or my own devices rather, but I still wasn't happy. I don't know, I didn't feel quite good enough. So I tried searching for some better products online, you know, some professional design ones just for personal use, but nothing seemed optimal. Like the low-level laser machines seemed to be the most well-studied, but they just cost ridiculous amounts of money. And there were some weak LED devices, but even they cost hundreds of pounds. So this whole thing for me started from those initially unsatisfactory experiences. And having not found anything I was happy with, I set up Red Light Man, and that was a few years ago now.
Right, yeah. So you've gone through, I suppose, a lot of the technical side of it as well. I've experimented with some of those cheaper devices at home, but haven't really looked into the electronics and all that end of it, you know?
I mean, it's something totally unrelated to health and nutrition, isn't it? You know, the electrical side of things, but it's not too hard to get your head around. You know, you just need, you've got your AC electric coming from your electricity sockets, and you just need to convert that to a DC circuit to run through the LEDs. So once you've learned that and figured out how to solder an electrical circuit together, it's pretty simple.
Studies in PubMed, you know, everything from using higher energy with infrared, treating brain conditions and regenerating teeth in rodents. But I was wondering what you think are the sort of real world applications that people can use it for.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say you could treat almost anything, or at least improve on any condition. So typically, red light is used for skin issues, like specifically wound healing, but also eczema, acne, hair loss, even things like sunburn. You can get some good relief from red light. Then infrared light seems more suitable for things like arthritis or recovery from injuries, muscle injuries, things like back pain, even brain injury or brain trauma, and also things like hypothyroidism. But the light's not just for treating specific conditions, though. I mean, red and infrared will help you sleep better, we recover from exercise faster, just have more energy in general throughout the day, and in the long term, you should have a reduced rate of aging. So there's just so many potential applications, really.
Probably people notice that from just in the summertime or in places where you've got more sunlight, you generally have more energy, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It's the effects with melatonin and vitamin D production in the skin. But I think from sunlight in summer, you're still getting about, you're still getting a reasonable dose of red and infrared light. So it's definitely good.
But maybe you could just maybe define red and near infrared for anyone who doesn't know.
Sure. So red light is just the visible light that you find between the wavelengths of 600 nanometers and 700 nanometers. Now, near infrared is an invisible type of light, and near infrared covers a slightly longer wavelength range than red. But for the purpose of light therapy, we're just interested in the near infrared wavelengths of 700 nanometers to 900 nanometers, and in some instances up to 1,000 in some studies. Above about 900 nanometers, the light is all blocked. Well, it's progressively blocked by water, so it's just hitting the water molecules in your cells and being converted to heat energy. But you can still have some effect even up at like 990 or 1,000 nanometers.
I've used the heat lamps, the infrared heat lamps, and of course they've a lot more heat energy as well, and they've a good therapeutic effect, but it's obviously not exactly the same thing. It's not as focused with the wavelengths that you're targeting.
Yeah, I think that they're still good. And I mean, there's a type of therapy called heat therapy, which, has some studies behind it. So I suppose those heat lamps are sort of a combination of light therapy and heat therapy in a way.
Do you know much about the effects of UV or how they contrast to each other?
UV does have some similar effects to red in terms of things like vasodilation. So it'll improve local blood flow, and UV can actually help alleviate some conditions like psoriasis, which red light will also alleviate. And, UV has some beneficial effects that red light doesn't have, like we've mentioned with vitamin D production. But it's just that UV has a dark side. It can be destructive. It can lead to cell damage, inflammation, sunburn, obviously, but also eye damage. And UV and blue are both linked to harming mitochondrial function. And not just that, it can permanently damage your eyes. So red light is safer, because it's unlikely to cause damage, even at high doses. And it's acting on a much more beneficial mechanism in the body.
I've seen studies showing that red light can reverse some of the eye damage done by blue light. Another thing was Niels Ryberg Finsen won the Nobel Prize in 1903 for, I think it was UV light, either killing smallpox or curing the scars. I can't remember now. But
Yeah, I don't know much about that.
Recently, there's been a lot of change in the general lighting technology. The light bulbs, these green energy light bulbs that were being made to take in various places. Can you explain maybe some of the potential problems with them and the differences in the wavelengths that they give out?
Yeah, sure. I've noticed this as well, that the spectrum from household lights has gotten worse recently, but it's street lights as well, the lights in the streets, motorways and that place. So it's just the shift away from traditional incandescent bulbs to the more energy efficient LEDs and energy saving bulbs just means we're getting more exposure to blue light, or a higher proportion of blue light in our homes and just in our lives in general. And that's linked to so many negative effects, like we mentioned eye damage, but sleep problems as well. And this applies to streetlights as well. In my neighborhood, I've noticed we used to have amber streetlights, but in the last year or two, they've been replaced by these bright white LEDs. And, this might save on electricity costs for the local council, but there's actually evidence that it has wide-ranging negative effects on the whole ecosystem, not just on humans, but it's got a sterilizing effect on insects, and that has effects up the food chain to rodents, birds, and different animals. So not just bad for us, but it's bad for the whole environment, really. But I think for your average person who's interested in this, the best solution for your household lighting is to get RGB LED bulbs. So they're just bulbs that allow you to change the emitted color with an app on your phone or a remote control. So at night, you can just set your household lighting to amber or red. And if you're doing color sensitive work, you can still set it to a white color if you want.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know about those. I'm still trying to use the incandescent bulbs as much as I can, you know, at least in the rooms where I'm spending a lot of time.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine, obviously. It's just they're using a lot more energy. And, you know, if you're using an LED that's emitting amber or red, it's going to be a pretty similar wavelength or even better than incandescents.
Originally, the experiments and the discoveries with red and near-infrared light were with lasers. And more recently, now we've got LED technology, which has the same ability for a narrow band. Maybe you could explain the difference between those and whether laser is necessary or if there's any major differences.
I think they're both effective, and that's in similar wavelength ranges and similar doses. I think laser light is potentially slightly better because it's in a state called coherence, which basically means the photons are more organized and may have a slightly better penetration into the skin, but it's not by much. And all things considered, LEDs are much cheaper and also considered safer. So I think they're both good options, and you definitely don't need a laser to get, you know, good effects.
So let's look at some of the factors in dosing then, and the metrics. I know you've a good guide on your site. I tried to knock up some notes myself for mine. So I don't know where you want to start. Maybe power density.
Yeah, sure. So assuming you have a light source that's only emitting light between wavelengths of 600 and 900 or 1,000, you can measure the power density quite reliably and usefully. So power density is probably the main metric we need for calculating a dose. It's also known as energy density, or I suppose you could call it light intensity. It's basically just a measure of that. So it's basically a measure of how many photons are passing through an area of space.
Yeah.
So it's measured in milliwatts per centimeter squared, at least for the purposes of light therapy and in the laser studies. So it's just how many watts of light are in a squared centimeter of space or of area. But that, you know, there are other ways to measure light, such as lux and, you know, different metrics for measuring it. But in light therapy, we basically use this milliwatts per centimeter squared.
How would you see maybe the importance of joules versus energy density?
I think power density or energy density is one of the most important factors, especially in studies on the skin or single layers of cells. Because, you know, too low of a power density and you get no effect, but too high of a power density and you'll short circuit a cell in a way. But joules are just the measure of watts per second. So 1 watt of energy used for 1 second is 1 joule. Joules are just a way to measure the total energy applied to the body. So like power density, I'd say they're pretty important, although it's not the only factor that determines effectiveness.
There's one study I saw, and I haven't seen anything else to back it up, but I thought it was interesting. It was a rodent study for induced arthritis, and they tested different power outputs, so different joule measurements and different illumination times and different energy densities. And they found that the illumination time was actually important regardless of all the other things. Have you seen anything like that, or what do you think of that?
That's the only study I've actually heard of looking at that, but yeah, I'm not sure about it. I do think there's definitely more to this whole puzzle than just energy density or the dose in joules, but just haven't seen any other research that's discussed illumination time like that. But still, I think it's definitely something that people should consider and experiment with, and definitely like to see some more data on that, but it's interesting, definitely.
I have an infrared device that 10 to 15 minutes has a good effect, and any more or a shorter time than that, it doesn't really have any beneficial effect at all, and it actually sort of feels warm and comfortably warm, you know?
Yeah, I'd really like to know what's actually going on the cellular level. Like, is it just that too much energy applied in too short of time doesn't have enough time to like flood the cells with the light. I've noticed that sort of thing as well, that sometimes if I use my light from a greater distance than would usually be recommended, but I use it for up to 20 minutes or even 30 minutes, do seem to feel good afterwards and the next day. So it's definitely an interesting area.
And there is there's a paper on the biphasic dose response. So that's that too much or too little light energy can have negative effects, whereas within a certain window, it has the beneficial effects.
It's quite a well-known theory in the light therapy world. It's similar to the concept of hormesis, isn't it? Where low doses are good and have a stimulatory effect, but high doses are inhibitory or negative. So it's similar to exercise. You know, 20 minutes of weightlifting is good, but 2 hours isn't necessarily going to be good. And you know, just like drugs, you have a specific dose that's going to be effective, and too much can be bad. And with supplements, and it's just a case of too much of a good thing. But you know, it's a common concept in low level laser therapy and photobiomodulation. But I don't think it's that applicable to everyday light therapy on humans. It's true that providing an excessive amount of energy to a single cell will give a neutral or negative result, but this is usually on single layers of cells, such as studies done on sperm cells in a petri dish, or even on, you know, the top layer of skin. Providing massive doses of light to the skin may inhibit or will inhibit that top layer of skin cells, but the layers of cells underneath will receive a more reasonable dose. You know, and then the fat tissue, the muscles, they're going to receive an even lower dose, which won't necessarily be inhibitory. And then also in your treatment area, you've got blood coming through, and because blood's passing by quite quickly, that's not going to be overstimulated. So even if you're giving a high dose, it might be negative for the skin in terms of this biphasic dose response, but the blood can pass other benefits to the rest of the body. So I think it's an interesting concept, but it's not something I'd really worry about for humans. I just wouldn't use a light for, say, 2 hours in the exact same spot on your body.
Potential feedback mechanisms then when you're using it on an organism rather than cells or...
Yeah, you definitely need higher doses in large organisms than you do when you study in, you know, single layers of cells in petri dishes and stuff.
With a lot of the devices, they talk about the lens angle. I wonder how important that is. And
yeah, this is something I've tested quite a bit. The beam angle I find crucially important. So you can have a beam angle based on the lens or use a reflector, but it's the same concept in LED grow lights for growing plants. If the beam angle is more than 90 degrees, the light's just being spread over such a wide area that the power density will drop off so fast, meaning that you can't use the light from more than a few centimeters away. So especially with lower watt LED devices, you should be looking for a narrow spotlight type of light. And with the higher watt LED lights, you know, ones that have a concentrated intense light source, you can increase the beam angle by up to maybe 80 degrees. But even if you have 100 watts of red LEDs, you're not going to have a good power density if the beam angle is too wide. So it's much like laser light it's coming out at quite a narrow angle. You want that with LEDs as well.
If you were to look at maybe dosing, what do you look for? How would you go about calculating a dose?
Yeah, well, I do suggest, if you've got a particular condition, to find studies that were that study in your particular condition and have a dose value there. So just so you can replicate that study and hopefully get those same effects. The drawback is that a lot of these studies don't always have the best metrics to describe dose or power density. You know, there's no uniform standardized metrics used in all studies at the moment. And also the dose between different studies that seems to be effective can vary so much. You know, you have one study that says 1 joule per centimeter squared is effective, but then you've got another study that says 700 joules per centimeter squared is effective. So it's not that easy, but in general, I think a couple of minutes with a reasonable strength of light is good for the skin treatment. You're just less than 5 minutes or maybe up to 10 minutes, and then 10 or 15 minutes for anything deeper, you know, anything below the skin. And it's even more complicated, really, because I think the necessary dose varies between different individuals, depending on the skin tone, how tanned you are, how thick your skin is, how many scars you have, just different parts of the body. And even within a person, I think the dose that you require will vary day to day. So rather than trying to replicate a specific dose, I think experimentation is more important. Although I do definitely recommend looking into studies just to get sort of a baseline dose to sort of aim for to start with, you know. To calculate that, once you have a dose, let's say you have eczema and the study you found uses a dose of 10 joules per centimeter squared, and then you've got a light that outputs 100 milliwatts per centimeter squared of light, you simply just divide the dose of 10 joules by the energy density, which was 100 milliwatts, which is 0.1 watts. So it's just 10 divided by 0.1, so that's 10 joules divided by 0.1 watts energy density. And that'll just give you the 100 seconds. So it's quite simple to calculate the time you need to use the lights.
Have you looked at the higher energy experiments? They use pulsing.
Yeah, so there's still a lot of debate on this. I noticed a lot of the meta-analyses don't show anything conclusive, but pulsing usually uses higher power densities than continuous light. So it's just a simple on-off repeating pattern in the lights that has been studied quite a bit, but it's nothing conclusive. I'm open to the idea that pulsing the light at specific intervals and perhaps with different wavelengths at different times might be beneficial. And I think one of the main benefits of pulsing is that you're able to achieve high doses of light without providing too much heat like you would get from continuous light. But like I said, I think there still needs to be a lot more research into pulsing before anything conclusive can be said. But I do imagine in the future that, like, let's say 100 years in the future when the science is a lot more advanced, I can imagine a light that it's tuned to pulse specific wavelengths at specific intervals, and then different wavelength will pulse after that, and you know, different, like, let's say 830 nanometer pulse first and then a 670 nanometer pulse. And I can imagine how that might push electrons through the mitochondria quite effectively. But, you know, we don't have the science to know any of that yet. But there's definitely a lot of potential to pulsing.
So can you tell us about some of the conditions you've listed on the site? You've got a few posts on it there. Perhaps you could tell us about the treatment of acne.
This is one of the most common uses for light therapy. And it's not necessarily photobiomodulation, because blue light is commonly used for acne rather than red or infrared. But basically, the blue light is absorbed by pigments in acne bacteria, which leads to a sort of destructive chain reaction in the cells, killing them. But red light and infrared are also effective for acne. The mechanism for that is unclear, at least compared to the blue light mechanism, but it could be down to the biphasic dose response that we've talked about. You know, like the high dose of light is just weakening the acne bacteria. One thing that's interesting with the acne light therapy is that blue and red combination therapy seems more effective than either blue or red alone. And, you know, there's a lot of studies showing this, and the studies showing blue and infrared combination therapy is actually worse than blue-red for some reason. It could just be the doses used or something to do with the penetration of the infrared, but blue and red combination seems better. And it probably works well because the blue light is killing the bacteria through that, stimulating that pigment, and then the red light is actually protecting your skin and alleviating the damage that the blue light could do to your skin. So I think you can still just use just red light. You don't need blue light for acne treatment, but a lot of the studies, and even which are short term, do show blue and red combination to be the best way to treat acne.
There's a lot of studies with, I think, red light and a compound called methylene blue.
Yeah, that's called photodynamic therapy, isn't it? Where you're using a blue dye and stimulating it with red light. It might be similar to this mechanism in the acne where the blue dye is getting into a cell and then the red light is somehow energizing that and it causes a destructive reaction in the cell. But yeah, photodynamic therapy is something that I definitely want to look into a bit more. I think it's a good compound to use in combination with light therapy because it's working on a very similar mechanism.
And another thing then you have is arthritis.
Most of the studies that I found are on osteoarthritis and rheumatoid, which is the autoimmune arthritis. I didn't find a lot of studies on the less common types of arthritis. In general, for those two main types, it seems that infrared light is better than red, just due to the better penetration of infrared light. And seems like the effective treatment for osteoarthritis is to apply the infrared light directly to the painful joint. So if you have a painful knee, for example, you just put the light directly over the kneecap. It seems to give a pain relief over time, you know, over a few weeks of using it, but also quite quickly improves the local circulation and the joint function. I know a lot of people with arthritis, they feel like their joints are stiff and they can just have a shower or a bath or even just run their fingers or their body under hot water and it'll make it, you know, it'll improve their symptoms quite a bit. And, you know, red light can offer that same, or infrared light rather, can offer that same thing for osteoarthritis. Studies I've seen for rheumatoid arthritis are, it's a bit different because it's an autoimmune condition. So the light can, in theory, be applied anywhere on the body. It doesn't just have to be applied directly over the painful joint. So, you know, you could use the infrared light on the neck or the back or on your arm. Just because it's an autoimmune condition, light therapy anywhere in the body will help with the systemic inflammation. You know, it's shown to bring down these systemic inflammatory markers associated with rheumatoid and autoimmune conditions in general. I think there definitely are systemic effects to light, and to achieve those, you're gonna want a higher doses or more powerful lights.
We touched a little bit on skin and UV aging and the effects of red and infrared.
From what I've seen, I think red as opposed to infrared is better for preventing photoaging and typical UV skin damage and sunburn. I've seen some studies showing that near infrared has worse outcomes for photoaging than red. It might just be down to dose, like they're using too high of an infrared dose and it's overstimulating the skin. But if I ever have been in the sun too long and I've got sunburn, the first thing I do when I get home is just to use my red light on there. It's just reducing the immediate inflammation. It's stopping things like fibrosis happening. It's just a really good idea. There's a lot of studies on it as well.
I think maybe some of the effects are similar to what you get with aspirin or caffeine as well.
Yeah. It's working on the inflammation pathways and stopping the sunburn from happening. I suppose you could take a light out with you if you have a long enough extension lead.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things is, you know, people are looking to get their vitamin D up without taking supplements. So they're using UV lights, you know, and it would definitely be a good idea to use red as well.
Yeah, because those same vitamin D wavelengths also cause a lot of damage as well, don't they?
And you have another article on hair loss.
This is one of the most popular uses for light therapy, isn't it? I think it goes back right to the start of light therapy where I think they were shaving rat in some studies and they were trying to use red lasers to cause cancer in these shaved rats or skin cancer in the shaved rats. But what actually happened in the rats that were treated with red lasers is that the hair grew back much faster than the control group. So that was the start of light therapy. It was like an accidental, they thought red laser light would cause skin cancer in these rats, but it actually improved hair growth. I think both red and infrared light can help with hair loss, hair health, hair growth in general. Specific hair loss conditions like alopecia areata, for example, seem to respond very well to light, like a 50% or more increase in hair density after a few weeks. I think things like thyroid-related hair loss that some women get, and men as well, and old people, also responds quite well. The type of hair loss that most people are interested in, though, is the male pattern baldness, or the androgenic alopecia, which is the common one affecting men. And yeah, with that, I haven't seen anything that's too promising. It seems a bit harder to treat. Yeah, I certainly haven't heard of anyone regrowing their receding or thinning hair just using light alone. I think it will definitely slow down further hair loss, but there's just not enough understood about the real causes of male pattern baldness yet, or at least it seems like that to me, and it's not enough studies done with light yet. They haven't tested enough different dose ranges or different wavelengths and that sort of thing, so we just need more data. But it gets more complicated for individuals as well, because the density and color of the hair that you do still have on your head blocks light to varying degrees. For example, black hair or brown hair blocks more light than blonde or gray hair. So it just stops the light reaching the scalp. So calculating the dose becomes more complicated and has to be tailored to the individual rather than looking at any studies. So it's promising, especially for the conditions like alopecia areata, but the results for male pattern baldness are a bit more mixed. We just need more studies, really. I mean, a lot of the hair loss stuff, there were a few studies at 650 nanometer red light that showed some increases in hair density, and a lot of these devices like the helmets just jumped on those couple of preliminary studies, and now you see all these hair loss devices using 650 nanometers, and I just don't think that that's necessarily the best wavelength. It's just we don't have enough data yet.
Dude, I don't think we talked about the different peaks in effectiveness of the wavelengths.
Yeah, well, I think it's still a good wavelength. It's still going to give good effects, but there's been a series of studies done by a Russian researcher called Tina Karu. I think that's how you pronounce it anyway. And she's been studying these peak absorption ranges. Right? So she's discovered that there's four different ranges. So there's one peak around 620, and there's another peak around 670 nanometers. The next peak in the infrared range is at about 760 nanometers. And then the final of the four peaks is at 830 nanometers. So these four peaks, ranges, when you apply light at that range, it seems to give the best effect. So potentially you need to apply the light for less time or even at a lower density and it'll give a better effect. I think they're the best wavelength ranges to aim for, rather than just something like 650, which is dead in the middle of two, which might be 30% or 40% less effective than say 670 or 620.
I've spoken with Vladimir Haskan, and I don't know if you've seen his articles on light and thyroid.
I've had a lot of customers on our site interested in this, just using light on the front of the neck to target the thyroid gland. And it does make a lot of sense. It's something that I myself do regularly, even though I don't have any thyroid issue, at least I don't think I have. I don't think the available studies are conclusive by any means. There's a bunch of human studies of varying quality. Half of them are in non-English languages, like Ukrainian and Russian. And there are quite a few animal studies in rats and rabbits and smaller animals which show benefit too. The animal studies show benefit to thyroid hormone levels, like T3, from using light on the face or on the body, not even directly targeting the thyroid gland. I think there's a lot of potential to the idea, and I do think that applying high doses of light to the neck does give good benefits, at least in my experience. And if you have a weak light and you're only going to apply that light to one area in the body, I'd probably apply it just to my thyroid gland, because I think that's going to give you the best chance of broader systemic effects than, you know, than using it on your forearm, for example, or your foot. It's one of these areas we ideally need more studies on, a lot more long-term studies. I definitely encourage anyone, even with red light, but especially if they have an infrared light, to just try using it on the neck. Take your measurements of your pulse, your body temperature, but also just, you know, see if you notice anything over a few days after using it on the neck.
And you've commented on the effect of different sections of light on testicular function.
I first came across this concept of using light on the testicles a few years ago. I think it was through some news article or maybe a forum or something, but people were talking about using sunlight directly on the testicles, and that gave an increase in testosterone hormone levels. It made a lot of sense, and at the time when I was trying to think of the mechanism, I thought must be something to do with vitamin D production, and when vitamin D is produced in that area, it has such a big impact on testosterone production. But after seeing some animal studies on red light exposure on the testicles also increasing testosterone and even fertility, I became more interested in the idea. And I do think you have to be careful with this, more so than, say, using a light on your back or your face, as the sunlight and red light, I think they will definitely improve testicular function, but heat and blue light will be harmful to your testicle function. This is just because the testes hang from the body for a specific reason of operating at a lower temperature than the core body temperature. I think it's about the optimal temperature for the testes is about 34-35. It's just a couple below normal body temperature, so hence why applying heat there is a bad idea. And that can be from sunlight for too long, or even, you know, even LED red lights if you're using it for too long. And, you know, this applies especially to incandescents and heat lamps. You know, you definitely shouldn't be putting a heat lamp down there. I haven't found any studies looking at direct blue light exposure to the testicles, but there are studies showing that blue light harms mitochondrial energy production, which is essential for producing sperm and testosterone. But there are also studies showing that blue light kills sperm cells directly, whereas red light will improve sperm function and motility. So I think there's definitely a reason to be cautious with blue light and heat. But red light, at least in low doses, is good for the testes.
Definitely something you want to do your research on first anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
And then you've looked at dental applications. There's a lot of different things on dental and oral health.
I was surprised to find that there's heaps and heaps of studies on dental health with lasers, and it's used in quite a lot of clinics. I think the primary use for light, or red and infrared light, for dental health is to reduce sensitive teeth, also known as dentin hypersensitivity. So that's the layer of your teeth that's under the enamel. Red light can help to repair that. And I have actually experienced this myself when I had one of my lower front teeth. It's just suddenly started to be sensitive to cold, like very sensitive. And I started applying red light directly to it just for a few minutes a day. And it seemed to cure that sensitive tooth in less than a week. And it's never really come back. But other than that, red and infrared light seem very good for people with braces. So it reduces the constant pain that you have when you're wearing braces, and also seems to speed up the migration of teeth. It means you can get rid of the braces in a shorter time period, whereas your dentist might say you've got to keep these on for 6 months. Maybe you can get rid of them at 4 months or even 3 months. You know, it depends, but it definitely speeds it up at least to some extent. And there's also a lot of studies with light on oral surgery, so things like dental implants and root canals. You know, not only does it speed up the soft gum tissue healing, but it will also strengthen the bone in the jaw. And I think that's through interactions with osteoblast cells. They're just the cells that produce a collagen framework and deposit the calcium in, you know, so it's the cells that produce bone tissue, basically. I think red light has an effect on those. This whole thing of using light in your mouth is quite hard to set up. Shining light into your mouth, just holding your mouth open for minutes on end, is quite annoying. And you know, you can use higher power density lights and put that just on your cheek, and at least with infrared light, and to red light in a high power density will penetrate through the cheek. So you know, you can use a lower power density light if you're willing to just hold your mouth open, but you don't have to.
A lot of those effects are similar to the effects of vitamin K2. I've actually used it for tooth sensitivity, and maybe 5 milligrams a day for 3 or 4 days completely reversed it.
Oh, really? In just a few days? Yeah. I suppose it's working on a similar mechanism with the calcium and the osteoblast cells. I don't know, but sounds like something that would be good to try in combination, maybe.
And then the last thing that you have up on the site that is something I think a lot of people are interested in is weight loss.
There's quite a few studies on weight loss. Most of them that were effective use very high power broad spectrum bulbs, so like incandescents and HPS bulbs, which are typically bulbs that you use for growing plants. The studies seem to focus on patients that are doing cardio exercise, so on a stationary bike, for example, people will be cycling for up to half an hour, and they'll just have a series of these high power broad spectrum lights, you know, on their thighs or buttocks or stomach or wherever. And the studies do show benefits to weight loss. I think it's only a minor effect, and that's over a long period if you're consistent. It makes sense to me, though, because the improved energy production in the fat cells is going to mean they're just burning through the stored energy faster. I do think it's only a small effect, and it's not going to be enough to reverse the effects of a high-calorie diet, for example. So yeah, you can't just eat 10,000 calories a day and use a bit of light on your legs and hope to stay thin. I think with consistent long-term use, and also using light on the thyroid to boost systemic metabolism, that it will definitely aid fat loss in the area you apply it. But it's just not something that is going to be hugely effective alone. It's just, you know, something to consider as a small part of an overall weight loss regime, I suppose.
And so let's talk about some of the devices that you have.
Yeah, sure. Well, we've looked hard to get LEDs of specific wavelengths, so we're targeting the wavelengths in the peak absorption ranges from the Tina Caru studies. I think the general purpose red and infrared LEDs you find for things like plant grow lights or infrared security illuminators are usually about 660 nanometers or 850 nanometers, whereas we're providing 670 nanometers or 830 nanometers, you know, so just as close as we can to those peak absorption ranges. And with our lights, we test every single unit to make sure the power densities are in the right range. So, you know, with our products that it's going to work, you know, it's the right power density, it's the right wavelength, and we've calculated doses and times that you need to get those doses. So you're going to know how long to use it for, which you're not necessarily going to know if you buy a infrared illuminator. But, you know, having said that, I think you can definitely still get benefits from those more general purpose LEDs. And just LEDs in general emit less heat than, say, incandescents or heat lamps. So it's going to be a lot more comfortable to use, especially in summer, you know, which applies to our products as well. And, you know, the lack of heat in LEDs also makes them suitable for things like testicle exposure, which we've talked about. You know, and we've got all our products rated for, you know, full electrical safety, you know, to the UK, EU and US standards. So, you know, you're getting something safe and effective if you buy our products, basically. We've just released 3 new ones in the last few days. So we're trying to build loads of different types. You know, I'm always looking for new products, and I'm hoping in the future to have, you know, a series of broad spectrum lights where it's a combination of all the peak wavelengths in a single device at lower type of light at higher watt, and then the individual wavelengths at lower watt and higher watt. So, you know, we've got a lot more products on the horizon. So in general, we recommend the red light products for skin treatment, hair, and any issue that's located in the first few centimeters of the skin. And then since infrared light's more penetrative, we usually recommend that for deeper issues where you need the light to reach a few inches inside of the body. So, you know, the brain, muscles, back pain, that sort of thing. Once you've decided, well, once you've chosen between red and infrared, I think the next decision is if you want a low watt or a high watt device. And I think the benefit of the high watt devices is they're covering a larger area of skin. So from that perspective, it's offering a short treatment time and you're more likely to get these systemic effects that we've discussed. But a big advantage of the low watt devices, at least from our site, is that they're easier to use. You know, it's only 100 or 200 grams to hold. It doesn't get heavy, whereas the high watt devices are, you know, it's over a kilogram, so it's holding it up on your scalp for a few minutes gets quite heavy. But it's just a matter of personal preference. Just choose red or infrared and then high watt or low watt. But I think you can still get a lot of the benefits from the low watt devices. You'll just need to apply them for longer and be a bit more particular, like holding it on your thyroid or using it on your neck or somewhere where there's a lot of blood flow.
And I think we'll wrap it up now for that section. I think we're going to talk a little bit more about the mechanisms later on, but is there anything else that you want to leave us with?
Yeah, we've covered a lot here. All I'd say is you can find our products and articles at redlightman.com. Just search for Red Light Man on Google and you'll find it. Yeah, we've got new articles coming out every month and new products coming out almost as often, so stay tuned.
That is the end of the first part of the interview with Joe. There's a second part to the interview going out to the Patreon supporters that will be linked up on the site resonantfm.com along with Red Light Man and all our social media links. Thanks for listening.